You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show, and there's another guy who's part of this. His name is Hunter Motz, which is why I call it The Brian Callen Hunter Motz Show, because there wouldn't be esteemed and exciting guests without Hunter's exploration. And one of those esteemed and exciting guests is Mark Schatzker, who is from Canada. And he has written a book that was recommended to me by not only Hunter, but two other independent comics.
Whoa.
It's called The Dorito Effect. Mark Schatzker, welcome to the mother of all podcasts.
Thank you for having me.
Get ready for the Oprah Effect. I hope you like selling millions of books, because that's about to happen after this podcast. This is a really unique and interesting book because, you know, you break it down. This is really about flavor and the darks. I would argue this is about the dark side of flavor. The idea that when food scientists learned how to essentially create artificial flavors, and you use the example of the Dorito from 1964, everything changed from there, and not necessarily for the better. And I can't wait to have arguments with you about this. Mark Schatzker, what do you have to say?
Thanks for having me here. And I agree. I think it is about the dark side of flavor. I think it's also about the light side of flavor, though, which is to say deliciousness will be our salvation.
Mm, really? Yes. Well, because and the reason you say that, I want to put words in your mouth and tell me if I'm right, because, and you use some good examples, when you eat a food that has natural flavor to it, when you eat, for lack of a better word, because you use this word, an heirloom tomato, an heirloom peach, even an heirloom chicken. In other words, a piece of fruit or an animal that has been allowed to grow naturally the way it would almost in the wild, but at least eating its natural diet, etc. The flavor that is in that piece of food tends to satiate. There's something about the flavor where you get enough of it and your body stops wanting it. Whereas that doesn't seem to be the case with artificial flavors. We keep eating it because the artificial flavor essentially masks the fact that this piece of corn you're eating, or in this case a Dorito, has pretty much zero nutritional value. Is that right?
And a whole ton of calories. That's pretty much it. It's, you know, what we did when we figured out how to make fake flavors is we put flavors in a different nutritional context. I know that sounds really weird, but the one thing I can't say strongly enough is that flavor is not the enemy. Deliciousness is not the enemy. And too often in our food discourse, well, for one thing, we never talk about flavor. We're always obsessed with nutrients like carbohydrates or specific kinds of sugar, you know, corn sugar versus table sugar. What we never really talk about is deliciousness, the way food tastes, which is interesting because when we sit down to eat, that's the one thing we care about the most is how delicious is my food going to be? Even if you're on a particular diet, if you're eating paleo or South Beach or whatever, you buy the book with the best paleo or South Beach recipes because we're always trying to maximize flavor, which is to say deliciousness or the pleasure that we derive from food.
Yes.
And what I tried to do in this book is look at food through the lens of that pleasure. How did we change the language of pleasure in food, which is flavor? And when you look at that, it becomes very revealing. We changed two things. First of all, the real foods that we grow, the whole foods, the tomatoes, the chickens, cucumbers, carrots, are becoming less and less flavorful. They're becoming more and more bland. You know, when we say strawberries taste like cardboard, it's because they really do taste like cardboard compared to what strawberries are supposed to taste like. But the other big change is that we figured out in the mid-1950s, but that technology really kicked in around the 1960s, we figured out how to make flavor ourselves. And that was a big step. It used to be that nature is what made flavor, that if you wanted the flavor of an apple, you had to go get an apple.
In season.
In season, yes, and cook with it. And if it wasn't in season, it just didn't taste as good. If it was sitting around in a warehouse. When we figured out how to make what these flavors were, we started making them and adding them to all sorts of food. And that's why I called it the Dorito Effect, because Doritos are the best example of how powerful flavor technology is.
Your story about that is amazing. An ad man goes to Southern California, eats a tortilla chip and says, this is going to revolutionize everything. And I think he was working at Frito-Lay, and then decides, let's make this chip taste like a taco.
Well, so here's what's interesting about that story. This guy, you're right, an ad man. He was from Madison Avenue. He got poached by Frito-Lay to come and work in Dallas, Texas. And he was on holiday in Southern California, and he ate a tortilla chip at what his daughter described as a little Mexican shack by the side of the road. And he thought, okay, the tortilla chip is going to be the next big thing. So he brought the idea back to Frito-Lay, and they shot it down because they said, well, why would we want tortilla chips when we're already selling Fritos, which are pretty similar? And they had a good point, but this guy, his name was Arch West, was so confident in his tortilla chip idea that he actually funneled discretionary funds to an offsite facility to develop the tortilla chip, figured out how to make it, and he came up with a name, which meant little pieces of gold, and he brought it back to his fellow executives at Frito-Lay, and he said, I give you the Dorito. And they greenlit it, but what's so interesting about the first Dorito, the first bag of Doritos, is that they weren't flavored. They were just tortilla chips, like the ones that we dip in salsa or mm-hmm. bean dip or guac, and they didn't sell very well. They kind of bombed. They did okay in the Southwest, where there was a Hispanic cultural influence, and people knew that you could dip tortilla chips in salsa. But everywhere else, the complaint was, these chips sound Mexican, but they don't taste Mexican. And at this point, this guy Arch West had to face the bigwigs at Frito-Lay again, and they said, what are you going to do about Doritos? And he said, let's make them taste like taco. And this was a huge moment in the history of food because he actually got laughed at. They laughed at him, and they said, this guy doesn't know the difference between a thing and a flavor, because up until that point, things had their own flavors. Grapes tasted like grape. Fried chicken tasted like fried chicken. Now, though, Arch West knew that there was technology that
Did these people know there was technology?
So Arch West was friends with a guy named Lawrence Frank, who invented Lari seasoned salt. And no one really knows, but my guess it was through this guy that Arch West knew that there was this new technology that let you add flavor to whatever you wanted. So you could put fried chicken or a taco or cheese or whatever you wanted into a machine called a gas chromatograph and figure out what the flavor compounds were.
Once
you figure out what they were, you could make them yourself, and then you could add them to whatever you wanted. And the reason what Arch West did was so important is because up until that point, we had simple, crude, fake flavorings before then, but up until that point, flavor was pretty much the dominion of nature. And now, in the blink of an eye, it was up to the people in marketing who could just say, let's make it taste like grape. Let's make it taste like fried chicken. Let's make it taste like taco. And this was, think about what this did. This took a tortilla chip, a fried piece of cornmeal that no one was particularly interested in eating, and it turned into a fried piece of cornmeal that people literally could not stop eating.
I remember the first time I ate a tortilla. I'm not kidding. I mean, a Dorito. I remember it so well. It was nacho cheese, and I was like, this is the best thing I've ever had in my life. It was the best thing I could. And then again, I couldn't. I remember licking my fingers and then putting my fingers in the dust at the bottom of that frickin' bag. I'm not kidding.
No.
It was crazy.
Yeah, and think about that, because we're always so hung up on nutrients. We talk about salt or sugar or fat or carbs. And what changed the Dorito was essentially sensory technology. These things were pinging your taste buds and your olfactory receptors. The nutritional level of a Dorito, the nutrition in a salted Dorito versus a taco Dorito, completely the same. It was the flavoring that made you find that Dorito delicious.
Okay, but why is it that natural flavors satiate, and I think I know why, and artificial flavors don't? Is it because the artificial flavors are being applied to something of no nutritional value? Because you talk about this interesting phenomenon where they had goats, where one goat had there was a guy who starved goats. Or no, he didn't starve. He kept phosphorus out of
the goats.
He
would make them deficient
in phosphorus, and then he would put he'd give them, I guess, maple. He'd give them coconut, and he'd give them maple. Right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just, okay.
Yeah.
Yes,
this is
an amazing experiment, and it answers the question: why does food have flavor? And this is a question, oddly, we never ask. We just sort of assume food does have flavor, and we also assume that, oh, it's terrible. It's delicious. We can't stop eating. But really, why does it have flavor? I mean, if you actually look at our bodies, we're like flavor-sensing geniuses. If you look at the human genome, more of your genome is taken up with making your flavor sensing equipment, which is to say your nose and mouth, than any other part of your body, more than your sex organs, more than your brain.
That's
more than your
eyes. Speak for yourself, but keep going. Keep going. Sorry, I do very well in that area. Keep going.
He has large hands.
Yeah, you haven't seen my genome.
And his hands are huge.
Oh, yeah.
Huge. No stubby fingers over here.
All right, but keep going.
I've heard stories. I didn't believe them.
I'm 10 years old. I'm 10 years old. But keep going. Sorry, Mark.
So from an evolutionary point of view, flavor must be really important. Otherwise, you know, why would such a big chapter in our genome be devoted to it? So a scientist at Utah State University did a really interesting experiment with sheep. He made them deficient in phosphorus. They started doing all sorts of weird things that animals do when they become deficient in nutrients. They start drinking each other's urine and pawing at the dirt. So he really knew. He took blood tests. These guys are deficient in phosphorus. Then he did something really interesting. He divided them into pens. And in one pen, he would give them a feed flavored like coconut that didn't have phosphorus in it. But he'd give them the coconut-flavored feed. Then he put a tube down their throat, and he'd give them an infusion of phosphorus. Now, it was really important that it sounds mean. Why would anyone stick a tube down a sheep's throat? But he had to separate the flavor experience from the nutritional payload. He had to make sure they weren't tasting that phosphorus or, you know, what it was in. Then in the other pen, he gave them a maple-flavored feed. And then he gave the infusion of phosphorus. And what he found is that and then on the next day he'd switch it up so that the goats that got the coconut and phosphorus, then they'd get maple, but it would be paired with water. So in each pen, the flavor was paired with the important nutrient. And what he found is that eventually the goats learned, this coconut-flavored experience I have gives me, they didn't know it gives them phosphorus, but they felt better. They came to like it. They found it delicious. It's what they wanted to eat. Over in the other pen, where maple was paired with phosphorus, it was maple that they found delicious, and they couldn't care less about coconut. So what he found is that by pairing the flavor with the nutrient, the sheep learned what was good for them, and they experienced it as deliciousness. They didn't go, oh, yeah, there's phosphorusness. I should eat it. They said, wow, that's yummy. I really feel like eating that right now.
I wonder, though, if the pleasure mechanism was triggered by the fact that the phosphorus, that they felt immediately better after they had the tube down their throat. Because think about how unpleasant a tube down your throat is. You would think that when you would equate eating coconut-flavored feed with a tube down your throat, regardless of whether it's phosphorus or not, you'd be like, I don't want that coconut flavor because every time I eat the coconut, I get a tube down my throat. Yet they were able to sort of ignore that.
Well, I think that I don't know what goat consciousness is like.
I don't know what it's like for a goat. But what I think is interesting about that is that I wonder if it was that they just felt better after the phosphorus or somehow their body inherently knew. I wonder if it was a conscious feeling or if it was just...
I don't know that goats are conscious, I think the point is that there's some sort of Pavlovian conditioning mechanism going on here, where over time, as we eat foods, our body comes to realize, what has the chemicals that we need in it? And then, you know, the flavor is essentially the signal that says, there's phosphorus here or whatever it may be.
And it's really important that we have this ability to associate the experience of eating with something that might happen minutes or even an hour later. Because the one problem, one of the big reasons nutritionists have always ignored flavor is because so many of the micronutrients that we need to exist, like riboflavin and calcium and phosphorus and niacin, are totally inert from a flavor point of view. You can't taste them. So the nutritionists have always looked at that and said, well, nutrition has nothing to do with flavor because you can't taste them. But this is how it works. The problem with nutrients is they're very stable. They're very hard to sense until you metabolize them. So what we do, what we learned over eons and eons and eons of evolution, is to just inhale the vapor coming off food and pair that up. Say, if it smells like this, here's what I'm getting. Mm. And that's why it's a very effective and important system, because it gives us some idea of what we're eating before we eat it, when we smell it, and while we're eating it as we chew it and savor it.
And so essentially when you then come in and you give all these false signals on the outside of a Dorito that suggest flavor, 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 there's all these signals coming off, but then they're not actually paired to nutrition underneath it.
That's right. It's hijacking cues that were previously associated with nutrients and placing them in a context that in the moment you're experiencing all this pleasure, this is crunchy, it's so delicious, but then you don't get the nutritional reward that nature bakes into the equation.
And another important factor is when you get the nutrition you need, your body somehow has a mechanism that gets you to say, I'm satiated, I don't need any more of this particular food. Whereas that's not the case with Doritos.
And not just Doritos. I mean, I talk about Doritos being sort of the metaphor, but this is true of so much food. We add flavoring to so much food now, and we've all had these experiences where you start eating something that, I mean, it's interesting because we talk about Doritos being delicious, but if you rank them on, you know, the greatest foods you've ever eaten, for me, they don't rate that high.
No.
I tend to think of them as a food it's just sort of hard to stop eating them, but
mm-hmm.
I could never really rank a Dorito up there with like an amazing steak or a wonderful piece of dark chocolate or like a killer peach. Like, I love peaches. They've just gone out of season here, which is a disaster for me.
It'd be funny if you were just...
Well, Brian does eat peaches.
I do, but that's really interesting to me. But let me ask you this, Mark. Are you saying or have you found that, let's just take chicken, for example, because we know how chicken is farmed. And I think chickens mature when it used to be, it would take them, you know, like literally 3 months to 4 months to mature into a full-grown chicken. I think we have it down to 6 weeks now where you can actually eat them, or 8 weeks. It's like 2 months where you
can... No, 6 weeks, yeah.
Is it 6 weeks?
Like in the late 40s, it was around 14 or 15 weeks, and now it's about 6 weeks.
Yeah, so there you go. So my question
about... And they're bigger now at 6 weeks than they were at 14 weeks back then.
That's amazing. So are they less nutritious? Do we know that?
Yes, they are less nutritious. They're
really?
Fattier. There's a way higher ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fats than there used to be, and there's less nutritional density because the food they're eating is less nutritionally dense. It's just basically it's just macronutrient heavy. We give them enough micronutrients to make sure they keep living. They don't want them to die. They want them to live right up until the date of slaughter. But it is less nutritionally dense. It's the same is true of most of the meat we grow now. You know, grass-fed beef is much more nutritionally dense than grain-fed beef.
And so grass-fed beef also has more omega-3, I think.
More omega-3s.
Yeah.
Yep.
So the oil, the actual oil compounds in the meat is different. I mean, the oil profile is actually different, isn't it?
It's different, yeah. You can feel it in your hands. You know, when you wash your hands after you make patties from grass-fed beef, the fat just sort of washes off more easily because it's less saturated.
Wow. Well, I know that cows, you know, are natural. They eat grass. They're not going to eat. They can't live on just seed, right? I mean, it's not good for them.
No, not what they were meant to do.
But also, I mean, you know, to go back to a word that Brian used earlier, the word heirloom. So, I mean, a lot of what this comes down to is, you know, we've all had that experience of, you know, like you said, eating strawberries or eating tomatoes, and they taste like cardboard. So it's not just the way these things are raised; it's also what is actually being done to these varieties. So
that's a great point, and we keep selecting. We keep selecting agronomic traits, which is the agricultural traits that make us money. So mainly we're after yield. We want more meat. We want more strawberries. We want more tomatoes. We also, especially with plants, we want disease resistance, and we like shelf life. You don't want your strawberries to be mush by the time they get to the supermarket. Same with the tomatoes. The problem is when we keep selecting for these traits and we keep ignoring traits like nutrient density and flavor, you lose those traits. It's the equivalent of reverse evolutionary pressure. Tomatoes lost flavor for the same reason that we lost our tails, because if you don't need it and you don't select for it, it goes away.
Hmm.
So essentially, modern tomato varieties, even if you grow them organically in your backyard and you sing them lullabies, they can't be flavorful. They just don't really have the genetic know-how anymore.
Wow. Although that's not the case in Italy. That's not the case in certain parts of the world because they've been very, very... Their food's a religion in Italy.
You're right, but they're not... They're growing... They are paying a price for it in yield. They have a market, and we do it sometimes. I mean, we do it with craft beer and we do it with wine where we say, well, listen, I'll give you a bit more money to make it taste better. But for some reason, with so much of the food that we grow, North America, even though it's an incredibly wealthy continent, we sort of insist on eating the cheapest food possible.
Well, don't we have to, though, Mark? I mean, this is what I was going to talk to you about is, you know, Michael Pollan, the New York Times in their magazine this Sunday had a great article on food and big agro, big agriculture, and the monopolies therein. So, you know, I think four companies control 82% of our beef slaughter. I mean, you know, these are big conglomerates. If you look at the pesticide industry, if you look at the fertilizer industry, if you look at the companies that actually slaughter our beef, that package our beef, and then of course you got supermarkets and fast food chains. These are big monopolies that have a great deal of control and really do force a lot of smaller farms into contracts that are not very favorable to them. However, you have to. We are dealing with a huge population, and big factory farming has done a very good job of getting protein and much needed carbohydrates, etc., into the bodies of a massive working force and a bunch of children, school children. Yes, obesity is a problem. Yes, we eat too much of it. Yes, you know, there are certain, you know, it's almost a one crop economy in certain areas where it's soy and corn, and that's the biggest crop grown. So there are problems with that. But I don't know how in the world, Mark, we would ever feed. I mean, there are a couple problems with heirloom farming. I go to Erewhon. I have the money to buy heirloom produce. But if you're just a working class dude or a mother, you trying to get food that is just going to keep you going for the day is the deal. And I feel like what would happen, even if you had family farms, and I always talk about we should bring back the family farm, what would happen, first of all, is farms would be efficient and some would not be efficient. So you'd have fluctuations in price according to your region, depending on yield that month. And more importantly, what would probably happen is the effective farms would buy up the less effective farms.
And it's already happened.
Exactly. And so I feel like it would just revert back to the set point of factory farming exists because it's very efficient and it gets food into the stomachs of a massive number of people. So there is a necessity there. I'm not sure how we would stop that. However, there are people like you writing books, and I think a lot of people who go, you know what? Maybe, but I want flavor. I want to know where my food came from.
It's about more than flavor. It's about obesity. How much does obesity cost the United States every year?
Well, that's a
huge point. So the point is that, you know, it's the question of where's your money going. So Mark,
no, but I would also put it this way: if you look at obesity and so many nutritional problems or dysfunctions correlate with poverty, which is to say that section of the population you're talking about has this problem more than others, and they don't deserve that. And obesity, the price of obesity, it's the second leading cause of preventable death, and it's the first leading cause of preventable morbidity, which is a disease state. It causes more suffering even than smoking.
It's true.
So it's a really big problem. So to say, like, yes, there's obesity, I'm not saying you're saying that, but say, yes, there's obesity, but, you know, everyone's fed.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some truth to that. People do need to be fed. And the last thing I would advocate is that we need to go back to 1940-style farming. And whoa, who knows? Well, if the wheat crop doesn't work out, well, rich people will be okay, and poor people, that's just their tough luck. But what I would say to you is this. It's not a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. It's not calories or flavor. It's not food or flavor. You can't have both. And I want to tell you a story. I talked a little bit about the tomato. The guy who's done all that interesting work on the tomato is a guy named Harry Klee, who's at the University of Florida. He used to work for Monsanto when they tried to find a fix for the tomato through genetic engineering, and he found that didn't work. He essentially gave up and joined the faculty at the University of Florida to spend his life trying to figure out why tomatoes tasted so bad. A few years ago, he tried a simple experiment. For years and years, he'd been growing all sorts of different heirlooms, trying to find the most flavorful one. And what he found is actually the vast majority of heirlooms suck. There's only a small, not a handful, but a small subset of heirlooms that taste delicious. Most of them are awful.
Hmm.
And then within these delicious ones, he set out to find, well, which are the really, really, really good ones? And he finally settled on one that his sensory panels, hundreds and hundreds of evaluators at the University of Florida settled on. They gave it the highest score. It's called the Maglia Rosa. And it was a classic heirloom in the sense that,
I'm writing that
boy,
down.
Was it delicious.
And Maglia Rosa. Yeah.
And it was a pain to grow. It didn't grow well. It got diseases. It was sort of more like a shrub than a plant. Just a real pain to grow. So Harry Klee decided, I'm just going to cross this with a modern tomato, a tomato that has all the traits that food companies love, yield, good shelf life, and so forth. And he's going to cross with this flavorful one. He was hoping to sort of just get something in between, decent yield, decent shelf life, decent flavor. And what he got was like a super tomato, which is to say it had all the yield of the modern parent, it had the disease resistance, and it had the shelf life, but it had the same flavor as its heirloom parent.
Wow.
So you could get a tomato plant that in a good year, a single plant could grow 20 pounds of tomatoes.
Damn.
And not genetically engineered. This is just classic plant breeding, and it's got incredible flavor. So this solves the problem. So I'm not an advocate for heirloom farming. I don't think we should go back to the past. I think the past can inform the future, mm-hmm. but the past will not be the future. Of course we have more mouths to feed. We have far less farmland than we had in 1948.
Sure.
So of course we need yields. But I guess my point would be, and what Harry Klee discovered, is that you can have your cake and eat it too.
I think it's a great point, because we pay a price for abundance and efficiency. You pay a price in many ways. I mean, when you have...
We don't pay a price for abundance and efficiency. We pay price for, you know, what is, and I mean, I think that's the thing. As I read,
but what I'm saying is abundance and efficiency can give away, that can take the place of quality, right?
Well, so, but it's not, but that's the point. It's not about abundance and efficiency or quality. What Mark is talking about, this variety of tomato, gives you abundance, it gives you efficiency, and it gives you flavor. And as I read your book, Mark, and we talked about this a little bit over email, is that what's going on here is a cultural phenomenon. This is not about what rationally makes sense. This is about North American culture. Hmm. Because the big question has always been, why is it that French people eat whatever they want and don't get fat? Hmm. Why is it that Italians love food more than any other people in the world and they don't get fat? And, you know, since we're talking about tomatoes, there's an Italian restaurant in Naples called Don Michele, which supposedly has the best pizza in the world. And I've eaten it. And it's the best pizza in the world.
Yeah.
And the reality is that, you know, it's a fairly small pizza, but you eat it and the tomatoes that go into it are so flavorful that you just have that pizza and you're done. You don't want any more.
And the cheese is better.
And they
ferment their dough. So the dough has more flavor. And you eat a smaller pie and you walk away. You can walk away. You're not like, you don't have to, call an ambulance because you feel like having cardiac arrest because you ate so much pizza. And it was delicious.
I think what we're talking about is teaching people to know the difference. And a lot of Americans, I travel this country a great deal. A lot of Americans, I think, haven't even been exposed to the difference. A lot of Americans haven't had a pizza like you're talking about. And if they did, they probably would crave that. It's like kind of when you drink cheap wine and then you have your first glass of really good wine,
mm-hmm.
or you drink bad coffee and then you have your first cup of really good coffee where it's roasted to perfection and everything else. It's very difficult to go back. So
these tomatoes that you're talking about, Mark, they satisfy all of the things that we're talking about, right? They had that yield, they produced lots of tomatoes, they had all those good qualities, and yet, you know, it's not necessarily that, and they had the flavor, but it's not necessarily that American farmers have embraced these varieties, right?
No, in fact, it's been very difficult. It's sort of endlessly depressing, the difficulty Harry Klee has had to get sort of big tomato to embrace these tomatoes, because they're a little bit smaller than regular tomatoes. And on the one hand, it makes total sense. The tomato growers look at it and they say, well, you know, yeah, it grows well, didn't get any disease. But they say, you know, the fruit size is a bit smaller, which means my labor costs are incrementally higher because there's more picks per kilogram than there would be with the larger tomatoes. So that means my costs go up. So unless someone's paying me for this, and none of the big supermarket chains have a little box that says flavor on it, why would I grow this tomato? So you kind of, at that point, want to blow your head off because you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah, but again, if people could taste the difference, they would start to crave those tomatoes.
Well,
right?
That's right.
So all of a sudden, people would say, don't get those big tomatoes. You got to get the mid-sized tomatoes, and these are the Amiglia rosa, cross breed, and they're sick. That's what would happen, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So you got to figure out how to light the fuse.
It's already being lit, though, Mark. Look at coffee. Everywhere you go. I was in Oklahoma in the smallest town you can imagine. Guess what? Found some of the best coffee I've ever found, because you got a couple of hipsters in there who went, I want good coffee. I don't want to drink Starbucks. I don't want to be part of a giant chain. All due respect to that company. I want a little house coffee, and I want shade grown, single source, organic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Damn good coffee, and they had a roaster in the premises. And this was in Oklahoma, and I find this in Grand Rapids, Michigan, all over the place, where you would back 10 years ago, good luck. Good luck
finding
Yeah, I found
the same thing in Mandan, North Dakota. I had some of the best pizza I've had in Mandan, North Dakota of all places.
Yeah. Omaha, Nebraska. Some of the best cuisine I've ever had. And it was just young people part of this culinary revolution who were talking about the stuff you're talking about, who were essentially saying, I want flavor.
Yeah.
Why does it belong to the Europeans? Why can't it belong to us? Right?
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And I think it is changing. And that's what's exciting. But to me, like, the big difference, you know, we often talk about what we should eat. What we really need to talk about is how do we get people to want this? And like you say, there is this sort of wave is growing, and it just needs to keep going.
You get it. You get people to know it by first reading The Dorito Effect.
Number one.
Yeah. That's how, by Mark Schatzker. That sounds almost like a superhero's name, but an intellectual one. Watch out, guys. The guy with the biggest brain is in the room, Mark Schatzker.
And that's actually, you know, instead of kabam or kapow, he goes, Schatz.
Yes. What's your name? Schatzker. Mark Schatzker.
They call him Schatz. Oh, yeah.
Dude, if we played basketball and I don't, I that's exactly what I'd be like. Schatz!
Yeah, you don't want to play basketball with me.
Yeah,
who's got?
I'm sure you're better than I am.
Yeah,
buddy.
Who's got the most flavorful tomatoes in town? They call them Schatz.
Yeah. Sorry, Mark.
But I think that's the thing. I mean, a large part of it is that what you're dealing with, and ironically, you know, a book that we talk about a lot on this podcast, The Diffusion of Innovations, which is the seminal text on how do ideas move, was originally written about agriculture. And specifically, what does it take to get farmers to adopt new innovations? And that is, I mean, you know, the whole point of Everett Rogers' book is that it really comes down to cultural effects.
And taking on very powerful lobbies.
And taking on powerful lobbies and, you know, essentially dealing with beliefs. And one of the big beliefs I think here is, you know, what the Chinese understood is let thy food be thy medicine. And, you know, food is medicine. If you put good food into your body, then you save in health costs down the road. If you eat Doritos, well, that's, you know, the people at Frito-Lay don't care about your long-term health. They could give two shits. You know, and you talked a lot about what are the flavorants, the chemicals they put in cow feed to get cows to
palatants. And pig feed. Yeah, absolutely. They know the animal science. They know it works really well. It's we've sort of adopted the very formula they use to get animals fat quickly. That's the formula we use for junk food. So it's really not a surprise.
No, it's not. And you know, the biggest issue is when Barack Obama, 8 years ago, and Michael Pollan wrote this sort of open letter to Barack Obama in the New York Times about 8 years ago, and he said, our biggest threat, if you're really serious about the world, you're serious about climate change, you're serious about terrorism, start with food. Well, what does that mean? And if you're serious about healthcare costs and you're serious about saving money, start with food. What do you mean? Well, four companies in different things it's now starting to change, but for the most part, it is a monopoly. So disrupting the food service would be easier because it's so concentrated in these large areas, these large firms. But also, the amount of environmental damage or waste that comes from agricultural runoff and feedlots and things like that, methane gas, et cetera, and by the way, the amount of processing that goes on when you have excess soy and corn, which is what we feed our animals
and our children,
and that is why is it not called adult onset diabetes? Why is it called type 2 diabetes? Because children are now getting diabetes, and so rather than worry so much about the guy who's going to set off a bomb next to you, the Islamic terrorist or whatever, it's probably the corn syrup and the sugar and the processed foods that are going to kill you before any of that stuff.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah, and
I'm quoting you, Mark.
I should have said
Mark Schatz.
Yeah, and in terms of all of this cultural stuff, a lot of this comes down to, you know, what Richard Nisbet talked about in The Geography of Thought, which is atomistic versus holistic perspectives. So Westerners in general, and especially Americans, tend to have this very atomistic perspective. They tend to see everything as these tiny little separate parts, and they break everything up into pieces, and that's why we're so individualistic and all of that stuff.
Well, it's also why we put omega-3 fatty acids in bread.
100%.
Once there's a study that says fish oil saves you, you know, and it's the miracle cure, all of a sudden you see it in everything.
But that's that's what we've done to food, is that we've broken it all down into its component parts, reassembled it, and then found out that it's not the same as the original.
But it, and we never question that. Europeans are better at that. I was at an ice cream place in Venice, and there was a big sign on the wall that basically said, "We don't use any flavorings." And this was just a total shock to me that they care, because I've never heard of an ice cream, you know, lover here even thinking about what goes into ice cream. But there they just had the sign saying, "We guarantee there are no fake flavorings," and that includes natural and artificial flavors.
Wow.
Which is probably something else we should talk about. And they just look at there's kind of a holiness to food there. There's a reverence that they have for real food. You know, another reason no one's ever looked at flavorings here is because they're non-toxic. These are the same chemicals that are in an apple, so what could possibly be wrong with putting that in a soda? And it comes down to, you got to look at the bigger picture. How does that change human behavior? This chemical may not give you cancer, but if it gets you to drink two cans of soda a day, that's a really big problem. It's not an acute problem in that you'll die from it tomorrow, but you will die from it in 20 or 30 years.
But what's interesting is that it's very difficult when Michelle Obama grew an organic garden in the White House. You know, she wasn't really allowed to use the word organic. She got a lot of flack from big agriculture for using the word organic. They were called, I think, organic limousine liberals or something. There was a great deal of, when Obama said we should bring back some family farms and these massive monopolies, we should look into the antitrust issues of these massive, farming monopolies. Boy, was there major blowback on that. You know, they had to step off. They didn't get very far because you got a very strong lobbying group, whether it's the Cattlemen's Association or, you know, the pig farmers or whatever it might be, or packaging or supermarkets or fast food. They've got a very strong presence in Washington. I don't think that's necessarily the enemy. I think they're just acting in their own interests.
I think they're just thinking really short term, because they should see this as an opportunity to make money.
Isn't Walmart into organic stuff now?
So they're starting. You're starting to see it. But I'll tell you something. If you look at chicken genetics, there's three really big companies. One of the big ones is called Hubbard. And Hubbard controls the genetics for a program they have in France called La Belle Rouge, which you can go to a supermarket there and you can buy La Belle Rouge chicken. And that's basically a chicken, sort of a style of chicken from the late 1940s.
Really?
And Hubbard, which is a company that makes tons and tons of money off these awful factory broilers that we can complain about till we're blue in the face, Hubbard also does a gangbusters business in Europe in these La Belle Rouge chickens. When you look at the Hubbard website, if you click on La Belle Rouge, it's, you know, for the discerning customer who wants flavor.
Wow.
So they're making money from this. There's lots of farms in France that are they have a limit of, I think, 10,000 birds a year, which sounds like a lot, but compared to North American chicken houses, it's tiny. But still, we're not talking about a flock of 30 chickens clucking around the barnyard. We're talking about 10,000.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Now, there's rules about they have to have access to the outdoors. They have to have this much space. You can't keep them indoors. They raise chickens much more in the way we'd like to think that chickens are raised. But the point is, there's money there. You can buy these chickens at a supermarket. You don't necessarily have to go to the fanciest food store in town or farmer's market. I love farmer's markets. But and the other thing that's so interesting is La Belle Rouge chickens in France have more than 50% of the whole chicken market. And
wow,
a lot of the people buying them are, it's not all rich people.
No.
It's not to say every chicken someone eats is La Belle Rouge, but there's lots of ordinary French people that know, oh, if I'm going to have some friends over on Friday night, I'm going to buy a La Belle Rouge chicken. And it's not insanely expensive. It's more expensive than a broiler. But they're willing to, you know, the French make less money, per capita GDP is lower, and they spend more of it on food. So a lot of it comes down to values.
I think that they said that the Russian Revolution and even the wall came down because people wanted to eat better. They were tired of waiting in line for bread. I mean, you know, it is true that people are willing to put food almost, I probably spend and always would spend more of my money by far on just food than anything else.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
I think the you know, I mean, the so something that I won't, I'm going to give you three things, Mark, and I want you to string together a coherent, brilliant statement from them. And if you can't do that,
no,
it's
pressure,
my
Mark.
Fault. It's my fault for, you know, being so vague. The first one is the Chicken of Tomorrow contest. Mm-hmm. The second is Julia Child. And then the third is bro chefs who are turning chicken into Doritos.
Okay, so the Chicken of Tomorrow contest was a contest held in 1948 to, quote, improve chickens. And this is what got us, it set us down the road to the factory broiler of today. Like we said earlier, chickens back then were around, you know, 14 to 16 weeks of age. And this was a contest where people said, if you can grow a chicken faster and get it plumper, you win first prize. And that's what set off this, you know, this mission that we were on to make chickens grow faster for decades to come. In 1961, Mastering the Art of French Cooking was published, and there's a great quote from Julia Child telling you what to look for in a chicken. And she says right there, you know, modern breeding has done much to produce plump, wonderful-looking chickens, but they taste, and I'm quoting, like teddy bear stuffing. So Julia Child noticed it even back then.
See, Julia Child ate teddy bears, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, your recipe
that's what
for
I get from
glazed teddy bears is incredible.
Right.
But interesting, and you find little snippets of it here and there in cookbooks where people talk about how chickens are flavorless. But for the most part, the culture, for some reason, people in France cared, and they said, no, we got to keep these old chickens around. Here, we didn't care. And when you look at chicken recipes over the years, they're getting more and more complex. If you look at a chicken recipe from 100 years ago, people just use salt and pepper. And it's not because they didn't have sage or they didn't know what sauces were. It's because they knew that a really good roast chicken just needed salt and pepper. And to do anything more would be overkill. Salt and pepper does not cut it now. We brine our chickens. We put fake smoke on them. We put rubs on them. It is so hard to make a chicken delicious that it's often just easier, you know, to buy chicken nuggets. And that's what a lot of people do because they're pre-flavored. And it's become this sort of, you know, you look at a lot of culinary culture now, and it's like people will take a chicken breast and they will smoke it, and then they'll roll it in panko, and then they put like Marmite on it, and then they put Dr. Pepper syrup on it, and it's just sort of the brilliance of the chef is everything you can do to make it taste awesome. And I would say there's two different religions in the world of chefs. Some chefs, they think they're God, and it's up to them to make the food taste delicious. They impose flavoring on it. And then there's other chefs who see it as their role to express nature, to express God, whatever you want to call it. They want to amplify the beauty that nature has expressed. They're two very different and very distinct culinary philosophies. And right now, I'd say North America, I mean, there's definitely this wave that you're talking about of people who are getting flavor, but we impose a lot of flavor on our food. We do a lot to it to make it taste good, and we do it because so much of it's bland. But I think the problem is that we've forgotten how to make real food, how to just sort of experience it on its own terms.
Yeah. Well, I always feel like Americans eat for the most part, for texture and for salt and for sweetness. The broad strokes are there, you know, people who eat McDonald's, like a Big Mac is fun. A Big Mac with that special sauce, you know. And
it's immediate, it's fun, it's easy, there's no chew, there's a remarkably small amount of effort to get that into your stomach.
Yeah.
But the problem is that, again, you know, food, it turns out, this thing that we've broken down into its components and sort of reassembled, turns out that there was more going on than we thought there was. And that's where, you know...
Well, look at you. I think you're right. I mean, that's exactly right. There is more going on. But I do think that it's permeating. Look at Chipotle. As you were talking, I just thought of Chipotle. Chipotle is nutritious, and they do their best to farm, you know, they'll say our pigs are sustainable and they're free roaming. And by the way, that's probably about 30% of their pigs because it's really hard to get the right pigs, but they do their best. Cilantro rice, you know.
Well, I think this gets the issue that Mark is talking about, natural versus artificial flavors. So why don't you tell us about that and just pop Brian's little bubble.
Yeah, Brian, you were saying earlier the difference between natural versus artificial flavors, and you were right. But there's a problem with wording. When people think of natural flavors, they think of like the flavor in an apple or the flavor in a steak. Mm-hmm. But here's why that word natural flavoring is such a problem, because when you see that on ingredients, people think it's natural. They think it's real. Mm-hmm. But legally, you can refer to a vial full of pure chemicals as natural flavors. So if you for example, if a parent goes out and buys apple granola bars for their kids and they see natural flavor on the back, they think, well, that's because there's apples in it, and that's apples of natural flavor. But what that means is they bought flavorings from a flavor company that create the experience of apples But chemically speaking, those flavorings could be identical to, quote, artificial flavors. But people get frightened by the word artificial. They think, oh, this is terrible. I would never eat that. But natural is safe. So it's just to say, if you want to be wary of fake flavors, look for those two words, artificial flavors or natural flavors. They're basically the same thing.
It's a little bit like local, too, when they say local produce. Yeah. That can be 200, 300 miles away.
There could be a feedlot next door. That's local beef, right?
Yeah, that's right. Local
but also
beef,
fundamentally right. In terms of just how, I mean, the thing that was most mind-blowing in the book is that natural vanilla often comes from pine cones.
It's so complex.
Sure. Pine cones are natural.
Yeah.
So is cocaine.
You get in the world of federal legislation and organic chemistry. It's not pretty.
But that's the amazing thing is if you want to have a natural flavor, you extract some chemical from pine cones and you extract some chemical from, whatever it is, and then you just reassemble it.
It's just reductionist.
Yeah.
What is a gas chronometer or whatever
gas
it is?
Chromatograph.
Gas chromatograph.
Chromatograph. Yeah. That's basically, it's a device that lets you figure out the chemical makeup of something. So before the gas chromatograph, let's take strawberries. Nobody really knew what made a strawberry taste like a strawberry. We had a good idea of the macro and micronutrients. We knew there's vitamin C and sugar and all sorts of stuff like that in a strawberry. But as far as what made a strawberry taste like a strawberry, nobody knew, because flavor compounds exist in such minute quantities. They're measured in parts per million, sometimes parts per billion, or even per trillion.
Wow.
There's just not a lot of this stuff in there.
Damn.
So in the 1930s and 40s, we just didn't know what made a strawberry taste like a strawberry. So the gas chromatograph, what you do is you take some strawberry and you'd volatilize it. You turn it into a gas, and it goes into this big tube. And in the tube, everything starts to separate out, so all the flavor compounds come out the other end one by one. And then you can capture them, and you can take them to a mass spectrometer, and that using that, you can figure out what the chemical actually is.
Damn.
And then you can knock it off. So that's what we did. So initially we had artificial flavoring. So you'd make the strawberry. Let's say there's about 15 to 20. There's a lot of flavor compounds in a strawberry, but in a fake strawberry flavor, let's say they'll use 15 to 20 chemicals, because you can't have all of them. That's just too expensive. Initially we made that artificially. So you'd make it from an organic compound of some sort, and you'd modify it in a big, ugly chemical plant. And then we figured out you could do it naturally. So you could, let's say there's 15 of these chemicals you want. Well, you'd be like, well, the one thing they won't use is strawberries to make a strawberry flavoring, because strawberries are just too expensive. So they say, well, here's one chemical. It's called cis-3-hexanol. We can get that from grass clippings. Oh, and here's another one. Well, we can get that from a bark. God. Oh, and here's another one. We can make that one from a yeast. Actually, we can genetically modify a yeast to make this chemical.
Good for you.
And you can call that a natural flavoring.
Yeah.
And then you put these things all together, and then you sniff and you go, oh, my God, that smells like strawberry.
Amazing.
But it's not. I mean, to call it natural really beggars belief.
Is there one major flavor that we put in a lot of different things? Is there a mother flavor? Like vanilla, I would imagine, is one of them.
And vanilla goes in a lot. No, there's a lot. There's flavors that recur all over nature. And actually, there's an interesting story in that. There's a guy named Steve Goff, a scientist. At the time, he was working for Syngenta. And he noticed that different flavors kept on occurring everywhere. And he wondered why that was. So he got together with this guy, Harry Klee, the tomato guy, and they looked at how tomatoes make their flavor, because this guy, Steve Goff, said, there's something deeper going on here, isn't there? And Harry Klee wanted to figure this out, because he said, well, if I can figure out how a tomato makes its flavor, I can figure out how to control flavor genetically. I could breed for it. I could have targets that I want to breed for. And what they did is they realized there's about 350 flavors in a tomato that we can sense, give or take. Most of them we completely ignore. Our brain just says, not interested, don't want to hear about it. There's about 26 that we zone in on. Our brain, physiologically, we're picking up lots of data, and our brain is just going, no, just want this one and this one. 26. They looked at how the tomato makes those 26 flavor compounds, and what they found is that the chemical precursors were always essential nutrients. So what does that mean? It means that when you bite into a tomato and go, oh my God, that's delicious, your brain is picking up chemicals that point to the nutrients, that were made from the nutrients your body can use. So that is really good evidence that we are just like those sheep, that we on some level know what we need to eat and that what we find delicious actually is in some kind of harmony with what our bodies actually need. We just really screwed it up by cleaving flavor from nutrition. If you think of those 26...
That's the premise of your book, by the way.
That is the premise.
Yeah.
So if you think of a ketchup-flavored potato chip, it has those 26 compounds that make your brain go, wow,
tomato.
And modern tomatoes don't. So which one are you going to eat?
Yeah.
But the point is that American obesity is, a function of American culture approaching food. Oh, let's break everything down into its component parts and reassemble it. And then, B, not really the fault of Americans. You know, Americans, in the same way that cows get tricked into eating this sort of bland nutritional stuff by the flavor compounds in there, the flavorants, Americans are being tricked into, like, mindlessly consuming this stuff. It's the Pringles slogan all over again. Once you pop, you can't stop.
Well, it's also the amount of sugar and simple carbs that we eat in our insulin
but
levels.
But again, they're hijacking our systems.
Yeah,
and flavor is the enabler. If the amount of sugar and simple carbs, nutritionally, I agree. That stuff gets into your body, and what does it do? Your body processes it into a fat. But let's think about sugar. Let's think about soft drinks. Soft drinks would all be the same if not for the flavoring. There would just be aisles and aisles of sugary soda water.
That's right.
Who would drink that?
Yeah, that's right.
The flavoring that makes Coke taste like Coke, that makes Dr. Pepper taste like Dr. Pepper, Sprite taste like Sprite, and it's the flavoring that makes a little kid taste that for the first time and go, oh, that's delicious, I want more. So flavorings are the handmaiden for these nutrients that are taking us to a very bad place.
Is there anything that tastes delicious that's immediately poisonous? I mean, I know there are plenty of things that taste delicious that are poisonous that'll give you diabetes, but is there anything in nature that tastes like a berry that tastes delicious but will kill you? Do you know?
Oh, that's a good question. There probably is the odd berry, and that's probably why we always had a lore about, learn what berries and mushrooms
and berries. Yeah.
I love mushrooms, and my brother's an amazing mushroom forager, and he says that one of the most deadly is the Amanita, and apparently it tastes great.
Wow. Oh. Could there be a nerdier thing to say? By the way, I love it. Listen, my brother's an amazing mushroom forager. I love it. But you know what? You need good mushroom foragers.
Do you know?
Thank God.
Do you know? So in Poland, the national sport is mushroom picking.
Really?
Yeah. So when my dad, way back in the 80s, he was privatizing, or late 90s, he was privatizing some companies in Poland, and they ran a competition within the company. And the reward for that, they said that the joke was that first prize was 2 weeks of mushroom picking. And second prize was 1 week of mushroom picking.
That's amazing. I was in Tuscany, man, and they came out to us and said, "We have this. We just pick these mushrooms over here, for you guys." And they were morales or morals.
Why did they have French accents in Tuscany?
Mark, this is the kind of attitude I can't take from you. God damn it.
Anyway.
It's a terrible French accent. Too. Yeah. They were French Italians.
They were French Italians.
It was on the border of France. Son of a bitch. Mark, thanks for your book, man. And
it's
thanks
a brilliant,
for joining
brilliant
us.
Book.
Yeah. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you so much for having me. It's a great interview, great questions. It's a pleasure to talk about.
Well, we always try to make sure we read the book because I'm sure you deal with a lot of people that don't actually read the book. And
I made sure to write it, which doesn't always happen either.
there you go. I know you wrote a book on steak, and you've written now a book on flavor. Do you have plans for a third book?
I do. I am interested in pleasure. That's all I will say.
Oh,
Jesus, Mark.
As am I.
Now, wait a minute, Mark.
Like it's a book about porn.
Here's a final question. Brian wants to know where he can get his tomato variety, and I want to know where I can get a Bard Rock chicken.
Okay. So the tomato variety, you can actually buy the seeds. Can you grow a tomato, Brian?
Brian can grow anything.
I got two big green thumbs. No, I've never grown a thing in my life. But
have you got a backyard or anything like that?
With fake grass, but it's all about drought resistance here. But give me, I can. I'm gonna have
a pot and a watering can.
Yes, I can do all that.
Okay, so you can get them from, if you just Google Harry Klee tomatoes, you will find his website at the University of Florida, and for a $10 donation that funds further research into delicious tomatoes, he'll send you 10 seeds.
Wow.
And grow your own.
And how do you spell his last name?
Klee.
Wow. Great. Harry Klee tomatoes. Okay, I'll do that.
Oh, wow.
And what about that chicken?
Yeah, the Bard Rock. Tell us the story about the Bard Rock chicken before you go.
Oh, it was, there was a woman who, she got married like in the 1950s, and she always tried to make chicken and dumplings for her husband. And he always said, no, not as good as my mother's, not as good as my mother's. And she basically gave up. I mean, she's just like, there's just no way I can satisfy this man. I've tried everything. I've tried every recipe possible. Finally, she's in this butcher shop called Crable's, which is in Kansas. And she sees a chicken. It kind of had looked a little yellowy or something. She said, oh, I'll give this a try. Didn't really think a whole lot about it. Made chicken and dumplings for her husband. And he said, you've done it. This is my mother's chicken and dumplings. And what she bought was a Bard Rock chicken, a local farmer, a guy obsessed with heirloom chickens, because it's kind of hard to make money with heirloom chickens, but he insisted on growing them, letting them outside to eat, you know, bugs and grass and all the stuff that chickens are supposed to eat. And this is the chicken that her husband remembered. And she finally created the meal he'd been craving for decades.
And this is not the same. This is not the same as an organic chicken. This is not the same as a Rosie's Organic or something.
No,
like that.
No, but there are some great chickens out there in California. I think, you really got to look at the label. I think Mary's Chicken has a slow-growing chicken.
Yeah.
But that's not to say they're all slow-growing. It's a combination of how slowly they grow and what they eat. So if you take a slow-growth chicken and just feed it corn and soy, it's not going to taste all that interesting.
Yeah.
If you take a fast-growing chicken and stick it in pasture, it's going to have such an incredible appetite because of its growth rate. It'll eat a lot of corn and soy. So you need the slower-growing chicken on pasture, and that's where you get this amazing thing called chicken flavor, which most people have never experienced. But chickens really do have flavor if you eat a real chicken.
And it's also, I mean, fundamentally, the Bard Rock is an heirloom chicken. It's a variety of chicken that comes from before the Chicken of Tomorrow contest.
Yes, that's right. It's sort of black and white. It's a beautiful-looking chicken, and it was a very popular chicken in the 1940s, and it's I don't want to say it's verging on extinct now, but it's just something for enthusiasts, really. But if you Google it, I would just look into farmers markets, check out your local scene, and just talk to the farmers and say, what's the variety? What are they eating? What's the age at slaughter? I know that sounds weird. What's the age at slaughter? But you got to ask that. If it's 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks, not going to be a very flavorful bird.
It's a fat baby. It's a fat, big baby.
It's a big, giant, fat baby. It's the chicken equivalent of steroid veal.
Yeah.
It's just not interesting. Once you get over 10 weeks, you're starting to get into flavor. I think the sweet spot's around 12 or 14 weeks. If you get into like 18 or 20-week-old chickens, those are super flavorful, but you're getting into having to use them for soup or stew because they'll be tougher.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we used to talk about things like stewing fowl, fryers, roasters, because depending on how old a chicken was, that demanded a certain kind of recipe. We've completely lost that.
I've been turkey hunting, and I've eaten the turkeys that we shot. And when I say we, it means I didn't get a turkey, but my buddy did. I was right next door. The point is, we dressed the bird in the field, and I ate it. And it was delicious. It tasted just like turkey, but better.
Yeah, exactly. It's always hard to – people say, well, what does it taste like? It's like it tastes like chicken, but more intense.
Yep. Yep. Well, Mark, thank you for your illuminating book and for taking the time. We really appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
You're making the world a tastier place, my friend, and not just with your looks. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Mark Schatzker.
The Dorito Effect. Buy it.
Talking about Schatz.
Buy it or read it or die.
Of obesity.
There you go. That's right. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks. Okay. Take care, guys.
There we go.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.